Genesis 45:16 to 47:12, the 42nd talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on October 26, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational use, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be starting in the 45th chapter of Genesis. The most dramatic part of this narrative, where Joseph reveals himself, is past, and now we get to some of the resolution following that event. But let me back up just a little bit and remind you of where we've been, what's happened. Joseph had been sold into slavery by his brothers many years earlier. Joseph had made his way to Egypt, and through a series of events, found himself the number two man in all of Egypt. And he had predicted that there would be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine, and had come up with a plan for how that could be dealt with. And so Pharaoh put him in charge of that plan, implementing that plan. The famine hit after the 7 years of plenty. The famine hit, and it affected not only Egypt, but it also affected Canaan. So Joseph's family had to come down to get food. That was the only place for them to get food. They came down once, and Joseph recognized his brothers, but he didn't reveal his identity. And he decided that he would put them through an experience of injustice. So he accused them of being spies, to which they replied, "No, we aren't. And to prove it, we have a brother back home." They go in, they give a bunch of information about themselves, and one fact is they have another brother back home. So he says, Joseph says to them, you have to go back and get that brother and bring him down to prove that you are not spies. So they go back home. They talk their father into letting them take Benjamin with them. So they come back the second time. Initially, all goes well. Benjamin is there. Joseph, the vizier, is satisfied. They dine with Joseph. But then the next day, they leave, and Joseph's steward comes running after them, and he says, "Who stole the cup? One of you stole the vizier's cup." And he goes through all of their bags, starting from the oldest down to the youngest, and in Benjamin's bag, sure enough, there's the cup. The steward had actually placed it there earlier, but the brothers didn't know that. Thank you. I'm sure you all realize I could not have fixed that. So they went down the second time. Benjamin was with them. Everything went well. Then the steward comes running after them, accuses them of having stolen the cup. Sure enough, in Benjamin's bag, there was the cup. So they had to go back. And the brothers, when they found out that the cup was in Benjamin's bag, they all wept and tore their clothes. A very different response from when they lost their brother Joseph, when they sold him into slavery. Here, with the loss of Benjamin, they are truly sorry that Benjamin is in this predicament. So they go back with him to face the vizier, rather than abandon him. And Judah, proposes that the vizier take them all into slavery rather than just taking Benjamin. The vizier says, no, far be it from me to take such a draconian measures. So then Judah takes the vizier aside and talks to him one-on-one. And he makes a wonderful speech. And it's, I think that what Judah is thinking is the same thing that I have thought when I have sometimes encountered bureaucracy. And you think, if only I could talk to someone with a heart and a mind and power to do something, we could get this straightened out. Because I have a reasonable case to make, and if I can just make that case, then we can get things resolved. And the case that he wants to make, he doesn't appeal to Joseph's compassion. To a certain extent, he does, but it's not just an emotional appeal. It's a very reasoned and very heartfelt appeal. He is just explaining to the vizier the situation, and that if Benjamin does not return, Judah's father will die of heartbreak. And so what Judah offers is, let me be made a slave instead of Benjamin. Can we just do that? And it's at that point that Joseph breaks down, and he tells everybody to clear the room, leave him alone with his brothers, and that's when he reveals who he is, that he is their long-lost brother. They are, the brothers, obviously, are scared to death. Here is Joseph, the second most powerful man in Egypt, the one that they sold into slavery a couple decades earlier. He's standing before them and he says, I'm the one you sold into slavery. So, and Joseph realizes that, and he asks them to come closer. And he explains to them that God was at work behind all of these events, providing for Jacob's family a salvation. And Joseph is playing a key role in this, that God had orchestrated all of this so that Jacob's family could be saved. And as a result of coming to this understanding, Joseph is able to forgive his brothers. He's not holding this against them. And then he weeps on the neck of each brother individually, indicating his compassion for them and his forgiveness. And then it says they talked. And I'm sure that that was a long and interesting discussion that they had, filling each other in on the events that had transpired in the last couple decades when they'd been separated. So that's where we left off last time. And we pick up then in chapter 45, verse 16. Now when the news was heard in Pharaoh's house that Joseph's brothers had come, it pleased Pharaoh and his servants. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your donkeys and go to the land of Canaan, and take your father and your households and come to me, and I will give you the best of the land of Egypt, and you shall eat the fat of the land. Now you are ordered, do this, take the wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives, and bring your father and come. And do not concern yourself with your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. Joseph earlier had told them that he was going to make arrangements for them all to move down into Egypt. Well, now Pharaoh has learned that Joseph has been reunited with his family. And now Pharaoh then gives these commands. Now, Joseph is very fortunate. I mean, in a lot of respects, Joseph is very fortunate. He's risen to the place of vizier, but not only that, but he has maintained good relations with the Pharaoh over this period of time, over these 9 years. And this revelation that of his origins, that he comes from a family of Canaanites, of shepherds, of hicks, of nobodies, this is not disparaging to Pharaoh. This is not a problem. Pharaoh is very gracious towards them as a result of his relationship with Joseph. So Pharaoh then says, go up, have your brothers go up and get all their household and bring them all down here. In fact, I'll even send wagons to make it easier, so it'll be possible for the young ones and for your father, and Jacob is 130 years old at this point, so the young ones and their father and their wives can all come down. And he says that they will be moved into the fat of the land in Egypt. It doesn't say where they're going to be moved to. And that's going to be a significant issue for Joseph. Joseph is concerned that they move to the right place. He doesn't want them to move to just any place in Egypt. We'll talk about that later. So Pharaoh makes a very generous offer and says on top of it, don't worry about packing up every little thing, because what you have back there is trivial by comparison to what you'll have here. Don't worry about every little thing there. We've got everything here. They're going to a better place. Don't hang on to the little trifles that you have back home. All right? 21 to 28. Then the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each of them he gave changes of garment, but to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. And to his father he sent as follows: 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and sustenance for his father on the journey. So he sent his brothers away. And as they departed, he said to them, do not quarrel on the journey. Then they went up from Egypt and came to the land of Canaan, to their father Jacob. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and indeed he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. But he was stunned, for he did not believe them. When they told him all the words of Joseph that he had spoken to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Then Israel said, it is enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. So Joseph gives them all the provisions that they need. First of all, he gives new garments to each of his brothers, but he gives extra to Benjamin, extra garments, and he also gives him a bunch of money. Joseph is trying to make up for lost time here. He's been separated from his full brother for a long period of time. Joseph didn't get to see Benjamin grow up in his formative years. He's missed out on a lot. And he's trying to find a way to show his love for Benjamin in a preferential way. Benjamin is singled out for preferential treatment by Joseph. And he sends to his father, he sends donkeys loaded with the best of things from Egypt, as well as donkeys full of provisions for their return journey. I think what Joseph is trying to do here is twofold. One is, it's just a gift to his father, that he loves his father and he's trying to express that. The other is, I think that he realizes that Jacob is going to be reluctant to come to Egypt. Jacob is 130 years old. That's pretty old for such a dramatic move. And I think that Joseph realizes that will be a bit of an obstacle. And so he's sending him these donkeys laden with gifts from Egypt, showing him that he needs to come to Egypt because that's where he can be taken care of. And that Joseph is in the position to be able to care for him with both the power and the wealth to do so. So that's what Joseph puts together as a caravan to go down across the desert. And that must have been an unusual sight, to see this caravan of wagons and donkeys that are fully laden with goods during this time of famine when there's not much available, and to see this go across the desert into Canaan. Then he warns his brothers. He says, "Do not quarrel on the journey." Very interesting comment. As I've talked about, I think the narrator has indicated to us that Joseph's brothers have changed. Joseph's brothers are sorry for what they had done. But I think we all recognize that it is human nature that you can be really sorry that something is done, that you've done something one day, and the next day that kind of erode away again. And I'm sure that we've all experienced that, and I'm sure that Joseph realized that that's going to happen with them. That there's a sense in which they're very sorry about what they've done, but there's another sense in which they haven't had time to really come to terms with the events that have just transpired. So they're going to be thinking, all the way back, they're going to be thinking, now how are we going to tell Jacob what happened? Jacob thinks that Joseph was killed by wild beasts. And now they have to tell him what really happened. And that's when we all become revisionist historians. We're all trying to couch the past in a way that makes us as hero-like as possible, or at least as least blameworthy as possible. So what's going to happen is they're all going to be talking and trying to rehearse what happened, and they're all going to say, "But I didn't," and "But you," and the recriminations begin. So I think that's what Joseph is anticipating here. And what he's saying is, don't do it. That it's necessary for them to truly come to terms with the past, not to figure out ways to recouch the past so that they are not blameworthy. They arrive then in Canaan, and they say to Jacob, "Joseph is alive and indeed is ruler over all the land of Egypt." Jacob was stunned. Jacob's thinking, Joseph was dead. I mean, I saw the garment, I saw the blood. And now the brothers have to say, well, this is what really happened. And Joseph is indeed alive. He's the number two man in Egypt. So they have to go through that whole account, laying out all the details for their father. Plus, his father looks out the window and he sees this caravan of wagons and these donkeys laden with goods from Egypt that he cannot otherwise account for. How did this happen? So Jacob, his spirit is revived. It's like Jacob has a new lease on life. His whole perspective on things has changed. And notice in verse 28 it says, "Then Israel said, it is enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." We've talked about this a little bit before in the question and answers, I think last time. The switch between the name Jacob and the name Israel. And here is particularly significant. That as Jacob is revived now, it says, "Then Israel said, it is enough." And I've been trying to piece together what is the significance of Jacob and what is the significance of Israel. And I'm not sure that I have nailed it yet, but I think this is helpful. That Jacob seems to be the name that's used with respect to him as a person, as an individual. But Israel is the name that seems to be used when we're talking about him as the head of a people. and the people that inherited the promises. And what we have now here is Israel, that is, Jacob as the figurehead of the entire nation now, has gathered a new lease on life and is headed for Egypt as a nation. And he says, I will go and see him before I die. He knows that his death is near. He's an old man. But he is going to see a son that he thought was dead for almost 20 years. He's going to see that son again. And that's obviously of great significance to him. Next section. So Israel set out with all he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here I am. And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will close your eyes. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which the Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their livestock and their property, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and came to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his grandsons with him, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. So they set out. Apparently, he started setting out from Hebron. That's the place where he apparently spent most of his time. Heads down towards Egypt. Well, that road's going to take him right through Beersheba. Beersheba's right on the way. At Beersheba, he stops and offers sacrifices. Apparently, there is an altar, the altar that his father had built at Beersheba, presumably is still there. And that's presumably why he stops. Now, if you will recall, his father Isaac had moved into an area near the Philistines, closer to the coast. And remember, he had said that his wife was his sister, that Rebekah was his sister. And Abimelech had taken her in as his wife. And then God had inflicted... That wasn't the plagues. I can't remember whether that was the plagues or when God spoke to him and said, don't touch her. I can't remember which one it is. Anyway, but then Isaac continues to live in that area, but he digs a well in order to provide water for his flocks. And then conflict develops between the local Philistines and Isaac and his servants over the ownership of the well. And each time Isaac moves a little further away in order to not have conflict with the Philistines. And he keeps moving further and digging another well and further and digging another well. And finally he moves all the way to Beersheba and digs a well there, and there's no conflict over that particular well. And it's at that time that God appears to Isaac and reiterates the promises that he had made to Abraham, reiterates those then to Isaac. So Beersheba is significant as the place where the promises were given once again to Isaac. And so Isaac built an altar there and worshiped God. Well, apparently this is the same altar then that Jacob stops at as he's headed towards Egypt. And he offers sacrifices on that altar. Then in the night, Jacob has a vision. God comes to him and God says, I am the God of your father. I am the God of your father who built this altar, is what he's implying. The one to whom I reiterated my promises. I'm that same God. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. Now, there's no indication prior to this that Jacob was actually afraid to go down to Egypt. But he may have been. There may have been some concern about going to Egypt. If you will recall, God had come to Isaac, his father, and said, "Don't go to Egypt." And now circumstances are carrying Jacob down to Egypt. So it could be that there's concern on Jacob's part, that this act may be the wrong thing to do. In any case, God comes to him and says, "Don't be afraid. I will go with you into Egypt," indicating that this God is not geographically challenged. This God is capable of being in Egypt and working and operating there just as well as in Canaan. And he says, he reiterates the promise, "I will make you into a great nation. I will go down with you to Egypt. I will also surely bring you up again." God is committed to bringing them back out. This promise doesn't make it clear, but Jacob is going to die in Egypt. But there is a sense in which Jacob will be brought back out of Egypt. That is, Israel will be brought out of Egypt. His bones will be brought out, but his descendants will also be brought out. And God says, "Joseph will surely close your eyes." Something that Jacob had given up hope on is going to happen. And that is, the son that he thought was dead is going to outlive him and be there at the time that Jacob dies and close his eyes. So Jacob then gets up, leaves Beersheba, and they make their way on down to Egypt with all of their possessions, all of their livestock, and all of their family. Sons, grandsons, daughters, granddaughters, and all the descendants. The next section, I think I will not read. It would take time, and it's mostly names that I don't know how to pronounce anyway. It says, "Now these are the names of the sons of Israel, Jacob and his sons, who went to Egypt." Then it goes through and lists, in order of the, it goes through listing first the sons of Leah and their descendants. Then it gives the sons of her maidservant and their descendants. Then it gives Rachel's sons and their descendants and Rachel's maidservant and her descendants. So I will not read it. Let me just make a few observations about this genealogy. It is particularly fraught with difficulties. First of all, just a few comments about remarks that are made and interlaced within the genealogy. One is, it refers to one of his descendants as Shaul, the son of a Canaanite, indicating that it must have become rare for the sons of Jacob to intermarry with the Canaanites. And from whence they drew their wives, it's not clear, but it appears to have been rare for them to intermarry with the Canaanites. Another comment. And Onan, the two oldest brothers of Judah, are listed here in this account. Then it goes on to list the sons of Perez, who was born of Tamar by Judah. And that was all an account that was talked about in chapter 39. Where, if you'll recall, Judah was irresponsible in not providing his sons to his daughter-in-law, whose husband had died. So according to custom, he should have provided his sons to her, through whom she could have offspring. And she arranged things so that she had sex with Judah and had offspring by him. And one of those offspring was Perez, and it indicates Perez's sons, Hezron and Hamul. Well, if you follow the chronology in Genesis 38, then Perez must have been about 1 year old when they make the trip to Egypt. So Hezron and Hamul would not have been in that caravan. And the language there changes slightly. So they are, even by the author, being singled out, indicating that they are different from the other people that have been listed in the genealogy. But that means we've got people listed in this genealogy, at least two, that didn't actually go from Canaan to Egypt, but were born afterwards. It mentions a daughter, Sarah. That's one of only two daughters that are listed. One is Dinah. She's listed, but we had a story about Dinah earlier in Genesis. Now we have another daughter of Jacob that's listed, Sarah. Obviously, I mean, presumably there were other daughters and granddaughters born to Jacob. In fact, it indicates that at the end of the previous chapter. So we are only getting two of the daughters in this genealogical list. Why Sarah is here? Presumably, she must have been known to the readers some other way. There must have been some story about her that would have been known to the readers. So those are the only two daughters that we have listed. There are two mentions of Laban in this genealogy, which recalls back to mind how Jacob's family came to be. The injustice that was involved there, as well as the family interactions, the difficult family interactions that created. Rachel, when she is brought up, she is singled out as Jacob's wife. She's the only one that has that designation. So she and her offspring have a special status in this genealogy. Okay. Now, it concludes by saying there were 70 in all that made their way to Egypt. It's hard to figure out how the number 70 was arrived at. I won't go into all the details, but it does break it down. It has a number after each wife, 33, and I can't remember what the other numbers. And those numbers do add up to 70. But how you get those numbers is hard to understand. And the best way to put it together actually ends up counting Jacob twice. Okay. I mention this because this would all have been bothersome to me because of its implications for inerrancy. But let me point out, there are some other difficulties here as well, and then I'll talk about why I'm not bothered by this. One is a similar list occurs in both Numbers 26:5 and then another place in 1 Chronicles, and I didn't write that citation down. But the names of spelling are different between this list and those lists. There are some missing in this list that are in the other list and vice versa. And there are some sons grandsons that are associated with other sons. So there are a number of disparities. Furthermore, this is different from what is in the Septuagint, which was a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek that was made about 300 BC. And there are some disparities, and in particular, the sum total is different. In the Septuagint, it has 75 rather than 70. And then in Acts, when Stephen gives his speech before he's stoned, when he's recounting the history of Israel, he uses the number 75 as the number of descendants of Abraham that descended into Egypt. There are two reasons why this is not terribly bothersome to me. The first is, I have come to realize that when you're dealing with texts that have to be copied and recopied and recopied, that there are certain kinds of errors that happen in the recopying that are very common. One of those is with respect to numbers. The other is with respect to names. Why is that the case? If you think about a sentence, the dog ran across the street. If you change something in that sentence, let's see. I should have thought about an example more precisely. The man went to the store. Let's say it's that sentence. Now it's recopied and it says, the man went to the store. So the E was changed to an A. There's a sense in which that's kind of self-correcting. You put that in context, and any reader is going to be able to see that that changing the E to an A was a mistake. What if you have a string of numbers and you change a digit? Is that self-correcting? Not unless there's context, because any number is equally possible. So numbers have a tendency to change easily. A similar thing happens with names, especially in a culture that has old names. If it's modern names, ones that we all recognize, that's one thing. But if it's older names where anything is possible, then it's easy for those to get changed around. So numbers and names are the things that generally are most susceptible to change when people are copying. And besides, if you were copying this, you'd probably go to sleep someplace in the middle of the genealogy. It gets a little monotonous and dull. The other thing is, we don't know what the author is trying to do with the genealogy. Why is it here? And I think we as modern readers need to have more flexible minds in thinking about this kind of thing. In particular here, it seems to me that the author has gone out of his way to try to make it work out so that it adds up to 70. And that 70 is significant. 70 seems to have a symbolic meaning of 7 times 10, which implies wholeness or completeness. So all of the descendants of Abraham were moved down into Egypt. Seems to be what the author is getting to. Now, as to who he includes in the genealogy and why and stuff, my suspicion is there are reasons that we can't recover. That they are thinking about genealogy differently than us. It is not his intention to have a comprehensive list of the people that physically walked across the sands from Canaan to Egypt. He has other purposes that he's carrying out here, and many of those, I suspect, are lost to us. So I will just leave it with those comments. Moving on to verse 28. Now he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out the way before him to Goshen, and they came into the land of Goshen. And Joseph prepared his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as he appeared before him, he fell on his neck and wept on his neck a long time. And then Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive." And Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh, and will say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for they have been keepers of livestock, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come about when Pharaoh calls you and says, "What is your occupation?" that you shall say, "Your servants have been keepers of livestock from our youth even until now, both we and our fathers, that you may live in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is loathsome to the Egyptians." So they come down. Joseph has obviously been eagerly anticipating this event. And he rushes it says that he prepares the chariot. Probably he didn't. He probably had his servants prepare it. But the narrator, indicating his eagerness, is saying, Joseph prepared the chariot. He climbs in the chariot, and they take off at breakneck speed. I know I'll get it right now. And to meet Jacob. And he sees Jacob. They greet each other, and he falls on Jacob's neck and weeps for a long time. He didn't say that with respect to any of the other brothers. So Joseph is really glad to see his father. And Jacob is also glad to see Joseph. And he says, now let me die, since I have seen your face, that you are still alive. There's a sense in which all the loose ends now have been taken care of in Jacob's life. There's kind of a completeness or wholeness that's been brought about in his life. And he says, now I can die. Then Joseph talks to his brothers and his father. And Joseph has, I mentioned before, Joseph has this concern with respect to where they end up in Egypt. And so he gives them instructions as to how they are supposed to deal, how they are supposed to interact with Pharaoh. They are supposed to make it really clear that they are shepherds. Their occupation is shepherds. And they have lots of livestock. And they're from Canaan. Because Joseph wants them to end up on the outskirts of Egypt, not in the heart of Egypt. And I think this is really interesting. Joseph's been in Egypt for a period of time. He's very familiar with the culture, with the country and the society. And I think that Joseph has come to the conclusion that this is, on the one hand, a wonderful place. It has a lot of wealth. It has a lot of goods. This is a great place to live. It is naturally blessed. But on the other hand, there is a rottenness at the heart of Egypt. That culturally, spiritually, there is a rottenness there. And Joseph is very concerned that his family end up not right in the middle of Egypt, where they will surely be seduced and enculturated. He wants them on the outskirts of Egypt. He wants them to land in Goshen, which is an area, as best we can reconstruct it, just east of the Nile Delta. And that's where he wants them to land. That is an area that's very conducive to pasture land, would be good for livestock. Okay. I'm going to try to get through one more section. Then Joseph went in and told Pharaoh and said, my father and my brothers and their flocks and their herds and all that they have come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen. And he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, what is your occupation? So they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds, both we and our fathers. And they said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please let your servants live in the land of Goshen. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is at your disposal. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them live in the land of Goshen. And you, if you know any capable men among them, then put them in charge of my livestock. Then Joseph brought his father Jacob and presented them to Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many years have you lived? And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from his presence. So Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had ordered. And Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with food according to their little ones. So 5 brothers were selected out as representatives of the family. They were sent to Pharaoh. They did just as they were instructed. They said, not only are we shepherds, but our fathers were shepherds, etc. So we're pure shepherds, nothing else. And that qualifies them for settling someplace outside of Egypt, because shepherds are not liked in Egypt. And so just as Joseph had anticipated, Pharaoh is amenable to the suggestion that they settle in Goshen. Then Jacob comes before Pharaoh, and he blesses Pharaoh, which is interesting, because Pharaoh should be in the position to bless Jacob, in a sense. Jacob blesses Pharaoh, and Pharaoh asks him, "How many years have you lived?" And Jacob responds and changes the words a little bit. He says, "The years of my sojourning are 130. Jacob is stressing the transiency of this existence. 130 years, but I'm just passing through. He goes on to say, "Few and unpleasant have been the years of my life." 130 seems like a long time. But by comparison with his father's, it is shorter, but it's not a lot shorter. And he is going to live another 14 years before he dies. The significant thing about his response, though, is "the unpleasant have been the years of my life." It really encourages the reader to think back over Jacob's life. And I hadn't really thought about it all in a piece, but if you think of it all in a piece, he's right. That Jacob, as you will recall, was born grasping at the heel of his brother. And there was a struggle right from the beginning between Jacob and his twin brother Esau. And that was a relationship that was difficult of resolution. And it was only later in his life that he was able to reach some kind of resolution with Esau. But as a result of that conflict, he flees and goes to Haran in Mesopotamia. And there he has that interaction with Laban, in which he's greatly taken advantage of by Laban. And yet Jacob endures that. And as a result of that situation with Laban, he ends up with more wives than he bargained for. He ends up not just with Rachel, whom he had wanted to marry, but he ends up with Rachel's sister Leah. And because of the tension between Rachel and Leah, then there's this competition for kids, and the two handmaidens become involved in this, and he gets two more wives. And it's not just four wives, but it's four wives among whom there is a lot of tension. And as a result, there's tension between their children. So his whole life then, from then on, is dominated by this tension within the family that results in one of his sons, Joseph, being sold into slavery. And he goes those years with thinking that Joseph has been dead, and then along comes the famine and the possibility of losing another son, Benjamin, and losing his son, Simeon, possibly. So if you think of it all in a piece, he's right. His life has been full of grief. His life has been a very difficult life, and that's what he's accentuating here. So, he blesses the Pharaoh, Jacob blesses Pharaoh, and then he leaves his presence, and Joseph settles all of his family then in Goshen. Now, I was going to make a few more comments, but let me try to leave a few minutes for questions.
It strikes me as odd that God promises Abraham this land, and then gives them this land, and then takes them out of it,
yeah,
and then takes them back to it, and there's all this incredible struggle to get back to it. They have to fight wars to get what was, quote unquote, promised to them.
Right.
And then slowly but surely they grow up in it. And then it gets all taken away from them again, and they're scattered throughout the whole world. I mean, what's going on there?
Well, we'll talk about this some more, but I suspect that Israel could say, short and unpleasant have been the years of my sojourn. I mean, Israel as a nation. That God replicates in the life of the nation Israel basically what he had done in the life of Jacob. That he filled it full of those kinds of tensions and conflict and struggle because of the benefit that comes from it. I mean, I think that's the point of the Joseph narrative, and we'll talk about that more next week. That was kind of what I was going to get into. But I think that's largely the point of it, is it's explaining why. Why the struggle?
I have a couple questions, I guess, there. Mm-hmm. First one, there's such an emphasis here on Joseph and his family and Rachel and all that. But in reality, the promise is ultimately given to Judah.
Right.
Which seems kind of interesting that there's so much time spent on him. And then, so I wonder if you have a comment about that. But then also, I'm wondering if there's any kind of even vague connection. There seems to be this emphasis with Judah on slavery. He recommends selling his brother into slavery. He's willing to take on the slavery in place of Benjamin. And, of course, then ultimately God takes the whole tribe of Judah out into slavery. I'm wondering if there's any, is that just my imagination? Or do you think there's some poetic justice or something going on there?
Yeah, I think there is something going on there. I still need to think about this a little bit more with respect to how what's going on here in Genesis relates to the bigger picture of what God is doing in the world. And my suspicion is that the term slavery there has particular significance for theological, it has particular theological significance, but I need to think more about how exactly that fits together. Oh, the one about Judah and Rachel. One of the themes in Genesis is that the expectations of man get turned on their head. That it is consistently the one that ought not inherit that inherits. And you can see in each case God engineering that and bringing that about, and he does it differently in each situation. But that is a common theme. So here you'd expect one of the sons of Rachel to inherit the promises. But that's not what happens. Once again, I think the expectation is turned on its head. It's Judah, and I think Jacob comes to the place where he sees Judah as the rightful one. That Reuben is disqualified by his grasping for his father's authority prematurely. Simeon is disqualified by his violence. I think Levi's the next and is similarly disqualified. Judah, in this last section, although he's been a jerk earlier, in this last section, he shows himself as one who has integrity and who demonstrates leadership. And I think Jacob comes to the place where he recognizes that there's a sense in which God has done that in Judah. And he acknowledges that, and he's the one that inherits then. Okay.